This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Wright Vinson looked out over the fields of his family's farm. It was October of 1861. He'd be leaving his parents shorthanded, right in the middle of harvest season. Far out on the horizon, the house he'd been building for his wife and baby son still stood unfinished.
He'd miss baby Charlie's first steps, and probably his first words, too. But, God willing, he'd be back for his son's first birthday.
10 months ago, Georgia had seceded from the Union. Wright didn't feel any particular allegiance to the new Confederate states, but everyone was whispering that they might institute a draft. A spry 22-year-old like Wright would have a hard time avoiding service, so his best option was to enlist now and secure a post as close to home as possible.
So, for the next 6 months, he'd be Private Wright Vinson of the Georgia State Troops. He packed his bag, grabbed his hunting rifle, and kissed his wife Christiana goodbye. Just 6 months and he'd be home again. But if Wright wanted to make it back alive, he'd have to battle against enemy troops, disease, starvation, weather, and exhaustion. He'd have to survive the deadliest war in American history.
Welcome to Survival, a Parcast original. I'm your host, Irma Blanco.
And I'm Tim Johnson. Every Monday, we'll take you inside incredible true stories of life or death situations. This is our first episode on the 57th Regiment of the Georgia Infantry. Of the approximately 1,000 soldiers who reported for duty in May 1862, less than 100 were still present when the Confederacy surrendered in April 1865.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
On January 19th, 1861, Georgia formally declared its secession from the United States. They were the fifth state to do so. And by the bombardment of Fort Sumter on April 12th, seven former states, including Georgia, had come together to form the Confederate States of America. To Northerners, the Civil War was waged to preserve the Union and motivated by the cause abolishing slavery, and particularly restricting the expansion of slavery to new Western states. To Southerners, it was a defense of their states' rights over the tyranny of a federal government and pushback against the will of President Abraham Lincoln, who was elected without a single Southern electoral vote. But to many of the men on the ground, on either side, their fight wasn't one of moral or patriotic duty. It was a legal obligation.
In April 1862, the Confederacy passed the first conscription act in U.S. history, making military service mandatory for 18 to 35-year-old men, except for white men who owned 20 or more slaves who were exempted from the draft so they could continue running their estates. By 1864, nearly a third of Confederate soldiers were conscripts, and over half of the military's ranks were poor, non-slave-owning farmers.
Among them were the Vinson brothers. Wright had only just turned 22 when the Civil War began. His wife, Christiana, gave birth to their first child that summer, in June 1861. His brother William, at 24, was unmarried, and as the oldest son of the family, taking over the family farm in Crawford County probably would have been his responsibility.
Little is known about the Vinson family, but they weren't wealthy, and they most likely worked the land themselves instead of relying on slave labor. William and Wright were semi-literate, but from their surviving letters, neither were well-educated, and neither had any personal stake in the outcome of the Civil War. But just months after the war began, rumors swirled that the Confederate government would institute a draft. Even before the Conscription Act was passed, the mere threat of a draft was enough to motivate droves of men to enlist, hoping to secure posts close to home. This was probably why William and Wright decided to enlist in the Georgia State Troops.
On October 14, 1861, the two brothers kissed their family goodbye and journeyed 15 miles south to the Fort Valley train station.
The trains from Fort Valley to the militia base in Savannah were brimming with new recruits. In fact, another set of brothers were heading out to Savannah that same week, Samuel and Robert Braswell.
The eldest Braswell, Billy, had been one of the first boys from Fort Valley to enlist that spring, and his two younger brothers were itching to join him. Samuel was 17 and ready to leave his sleepy rural town behind. Robert was only 14, but at a gangly 6'1", he was already taller than both his older brothers, so he wouldn't let his age stop him from following them into battle.
Like the Vinsons, the Braswell brothers didn't own any slaves, but their grandfather owned 85. In fact, their grandfather, Williamson Mims, was one of the wealthiest plantation owners in the area. The boys were motivated by the call to arms that swept through the South in 1861. Not a call to defend slavery, per se, but to defend their state's sovereignty against the tyranny of the Union.
The irony of fighting for the freedom to deprive other people of their freedom seemed to go over the Braswell boys' heads. They were drawn in by the allure of being a righteous rebel fighter. It was an adventure, an escape from the doldrums of small-town Georgia life.
That romantic vision of life in combat followed the new soldiers off the train when they arrived in Savannah. The coastal city's well-manicured parks and elegant architecture were magnificent compared to the humble farmhouses of the state's rural areas. For many of the farm boys from the inland valleys, this was the first time they'd seen the ocean.
The ocean was actually the reason why they'd been sent to Savannah in the first place. The coast was surrounded by small island bases that would be the first line of defense if the Union invaded Georgia by sea.
And in fact, right around the time the Vinsons and Braswells arrived at the camp in October 1861, a Union fleet attacked Hilton Head Island, just 25 miles north. The Yankees kept advancing south, capturing Port Royal on November 7th. Then taking Tybee and Wausau Islands on the 24th.
Before the new recruits had even been issued their weapons, they had their first task cut out for them. The new troops were sent out to stand guard at the only base that was left standing, Fort Pulaski.
Located on Cockspur Island, just off the coast of Georgia, Fort Pulaski was over 2 acres wide and fortified by 11-foot-thick brick walls. The alligator-infested marshes surrounding the island made it nearly impossible for enemy ships to get close enough to damage the walls with cannon fire.
Commanding Georgia's 1st Volunteer Brigade at Fort Pulaski was Colonel Charles Olmsted, a 24-year-old Savannah local. He'd graduated from Georgia Military Institute, but when it came to actual battle experience, he had none to speak of. When General Robert E. Lee toured the fort that autumn, he reassured Olmsted, "They will make it pretty warm for you here with shells, but they cannot breach your walls at that distance."
At least, that was the idea when the fort was constructed in the 1840s. But artillery technology had improved in the past two decades, and the new James-rifled cannon could launch an effective attack from 4 to 5 miles away. No one, not even Robert E. Lee or Union Commander Ulysses S. Grant, was sure whether Fort Pulaski's walls could withstand an attack by rifled cannons.
Withstanding an attack was the most the Georgia troops could hope for. Nearly a month after the new recruits were mustered in, their military weapons still hadn't arrived. They were standing guard with just the muskets and hunting rifles they'd brought from home.
The commander of Wright and William Vinson's brigade was Colonel William Barkalew, a fiery New Yorker who'd moved south in the 1840s and never looked back. Fed up with the lack of supplies, he decided to take matters into his own hands.
Barkalew armed his men with axes and bayonets, led them to the railroad, and ordered them to chop through the side of a supply train and steal whatever they could carry.
Barkalew was briefly put under military arrest, but the brigade marched away with the tents and supplies they needed, and with a newfound loyalty to their commanding officer.
By February 1862, Union ships had blockaded Cockspur Island from all sides and cut the telegraph line running from the island to Savannah. The troops at Fort Pulaski were now completely isolated. There was nothing to do but wait. Colonel Olmsted knew an attack was imminent, but as winter turned to spring, there was little sign of the troops who were occupying Tybee Island just a mile away.
The Yankees were biding their time. With the island blockaded, no supply ships could reach the fort after mid-February. All but 4 companies of troops were eventually sent back to the mainland in Savannah.
February passed, then March. And day after day, it was completely quiet on Tybee Island. Occasionally, lookouts at Fort Pulaski could spy a few men strolling across the sand, but there was no sign of an impending attack.
As April approached, the troops were growing antsy. The sticky summer heat was returning, and with it, the mosquitoes. Most of the men had arrived in October or November and had only enlisted for a 6-month contract. Their time was almost up. William and Wright Vinson were due to leave on April 14th, and Robert and Samuel Braswell were just a few days behind them. If the entire Savannah force left before the Union ships mounted their attack, the few hundred men left at Fort Pulaski would be in a dire position.
In the evenings, the officers at Fort Pulaski gathered to smoke and strategize in the balmy night air. Strategizing, at this point, meant floating improbable theories about when and how reinforcements might arrive to save them. Charles recalled, "It was generally felt, however, that we were permanently blockaded."
When they all quieted down and let the silence hang, they heard something.
The faint sound of work going on somewhere in the direction of Tybee Island.
Just beyond the sand dunes, Union troops had spent the past several months working quietly and only at night, hiding their progress from view. They were assembling the weapons that would test Fort Pulaski's strength, James rifled cannons.
Coming up, Fort Pulaski's defenses are put to the test.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to the story.
At 7 in the morning, on April 10th, 1862, a single boat paddled up to the coast of Cockspur Island, flying a white flag. The Union soldier on board delivered a message to Colonel Olmsted: surrender now and avoid the effusion of blood that was about to follow. If he refused, the United States Army would open fire on their fort in half an hour.
Olmsted, who had just turned 25 a week earlier, held the fate of Fort Pulaski's 385 men in his hands. Could their cannons actually breach the fort's 25-foot-tall, 11-foot-thick brick walls? There was no way to know for sure, but Olmsted thought he could call their bluff. He sent back a brief message. In reply, I can only say that I am here to defend the fort, not to surrender it.
With half an hour until the promised attack, the artillery scrambled into position. Ammunition was passed around, men were stationed at their posts, and at precisely 7:40 a.m., the first mortar shells burst across the swamp.
The bombardment continued all day, with 36 cannons and mortars firing off the coast of Tybee Island. The troops at Fort Pulaski counterfired, but they were outgunned and underprepared since supply ships hadn't been able to reach them since February. One by one, their guns and cannons became unserviceable. By dusk, the cannon fire from Tybee Island had slowed too. Not to a complete stop, but enough that Olmsted could venture outside and survey the damage.
What he saw was devastating. On the southeast edge of the fort, the outer wall of the casemate, the vaulted chamber surrounding the artillery, had been completely blown through. The structures on either side were only a few blows away from collapsing, too. The walls of Fort Pulaski were not indestructible. And if they kept fighting, there was only one way it could end.
Occasional bursts of cannon fire continued through the night, even as most of the Confederate troops retired to their barracks and went to sleep. Olmsted laid awake all night, weighing the burden that had been placed on his shoulders. He recalled, "It seemed to me that daylight would never come, and that I heard the explosion of every shell."
The next morning, the Union artillery focused all its energy on widening the hole that had been blown through Fort Pulaski's outer wall. By 2 in the afternoon, a shell blasted right into the magazine where all the barrels of gunpowder are stored.
The shell landed in the passageway, avoiding the gunpowder but filling the room with smoke and flames. Soldiers fled out into the halls in a panic. When Colonel Olmsted heard the commotion, he recalled, "There came to me the conviction that we had reached the end."
If another shell struck the magazine and ignited the stores of gunpowder, it would cause an explosion big enough to destroy the entire fort and kill all 385 men inside. With inadequate supplies and no outside help, there was no way for Olmsted's troops to win this battle.
Olmsted later wrote, "There are times when a soldier must hold his position to the last extremity, which means extermination. But this was not one of them. There was no end to be gained by continued resistance."
At 2:30 p.m., a white flag rose above the walls of Fort Pulaski. A boat paddled over from Tybee Island, and Olmsted signed off on their terms. Unconditional surrender.
The Confederate officers assembled around a table in the headquarters and, one by one, laid down their swords. Captain John McMahon, who'd served in the Mexican-American War, unbuckled his entire waist belt and threw it down, along with his sword, quipping, "Take it! I wore it in Mexico." As Charles Olmsted laid his weapon down on the table, he said, "I yield my sword, but I trust I have not disgraced it." Then the soldiers were shuffled out and the United States flag was raised over the rampart. Fort Pulaski, once again, belonged to the Union.
The 385 troops at the fort were taken prisoner and shipped off to Governor's Island in New York. Back in Savannah, the Vinson and Braswell brothers packed up their belongings and got ready to head home. The same day of the siege, they were officially mustered out of the Georgia State Troops.
They had made it through their service and were excited to return to their loved ones. But before they could board the train back to Fort Valley, news came down from the Confederate capital in Richmond, Virginia. On April 16, 1862, the Confederate government passed its first conscription act. All men between 18 and 35 were eligible for the draft, and the term of service for all men already enrolled in the military was extended to 3 years.
The Georgia State Troops were given a 30-day furlough to go home and prepare for the long haul. When they came back in May, they would be reorganized into the Confederate service.
The Vinsons had presumably enrolled in the Georgia State Troops to avoid a potential draft, but they didn't anticipate that the law would also apply to veterans who had already completed a tour of duty. Their strategy had backfired spectacularly.
The month off flew by in the blink of an eye. Wright finally got to hear 10-month-old Charlie babble his first words. But unless he came into some serious money, he wouldn't see Charlie again until he was speaking in full sentences.
The Conscription Act provided that men who were drafted could hire a substitute to take their place. But, as one would imagine, the going rate for a substitute was high, up to $3,000, the equivalent of over $75,000 today. Based on records that survived the war-torn South, over the course of the war, somewhere between 50,000 and 150,000 wealthy men were able to buy their way out of Confederate service, while lower-class farmers and tradesmen were stuck on the battlefield.
Conscription did nothing for the Army's morale. This was the exact sort of federal tyranny the Southern states had been trying to escape by seceding from the Union. Rather ironically, many drafted soldiers grumbled that they felt like slaves.
But the ranks weren't entirely full of unwilling conscripts. Robert Braswell, now 15 years old, was far too young for the draft, but he was back in Savannah and ready to fight. He joined the Vinsons in what was now the 57th Georgia Infantry Regiment, under the command of their old colonel, William Barkalew.
Charles Olmsted and his garrison were still being held as prisoners of war in New York, but a prisoner exchange was on the horizon. Soon he'd be back in Savannah, commanding his own unit, the 1st Georgia Infantry.
The 57th, meanwhile, was directed to report to Camp Randolph in Gordon County. It was a 300-mile journey, all the way into the northern mountains of Georgia. They set out on May 31st, 1862.
As the train rattled through the hills, Wright Vinson took up a pen and paper and drafted a letter to his wife, Christiana. He scribbled down, "Darling, I have seen some poor land since I left, and some very good, and some of the worst hills that I ever saw in my life." Describing an underpass tunnel through the mountains, he wrote, "We passed through it at about 12 o'clock in the day, and it was as dark as the dead hours of midnight. Darling, I wish that you could just see it. It looks like that you had started in to be killed, but it runs through in 5 minutes."
Judging by the grammar and spelling in his letters, Wright was only somewhat literate, and writing didn't come easy to him. But it was the only way for him to keep in contact with his family back home, and any sort of communication lessened the pain of being gone.
After a 2-week journey, the 57th Georgia arrived at Camp Randolph on June 14th. They were immediately put to work practicing drills and commands, using broomsticks instead of guns, since their firearms hadn't been issued yet. Some of the younger troops, like Robert Braswell, looked like little boys playing soldier.
The seriousness of the war didn't hit them until 3 weeks later, when they struck out for Chattanooga, Tennessee. When they arrived on July 5th, they were finally given their weapons. The 57th Georgia was now a real infantry unit.
Gripping his rifle, Wright Vinson realized the full weight of his burden. That same day, he penned a letter to Christiana, asking her to find him a substitute. All he could scrape together was $400, about $10,000 today, which he knew might not be enough to pay a substitute to take his place. So, if it wasn't possible, he asked her to go into Macon and get a daguerreotype taken, an early form of photography printed on a silver-coated copper plate. If he couldn't come home, he could at least see Christiana and baby Charlie's faces.
But before he could even send the letter, the regiment received new marching orders. The very next morning, they were sent to Camp Davis, 35 miles southwest of Chattanooga.
The 57th Georgia was beginning to feel more like a traveling circus than an army. But the men on the ground knew little to nothing about what their commanders were planning. So once again, they dutifully packed up their things and set out for the train station.
When they reached their new post in mid-July, they were thrust into the middle of a combat zone. Camp Davis was within sight of Yankee troops. Standing out on picket, Wright was only 300 yards away from the enemy. Finally, they were about to see some action.
But just a couple of weeks later, the 57th Georgia was called back to Chattanooga. And off they went, back in the direction from which they came. In late July, the men stepped off the train in Chattanooga, set up their tents,
and were promptly ordered to board another train to Knoxville.
Amidst all the confusion, Wright penned another letter to Christiana, telling her to hold off on sending that daguerreotype, or it would get lost in the mail. He'd let her know when he was in a more permanent position.
Even though they weren't seeing any combat, the constant mental and physical stress of being shuttled between battlefields would have had an effect on the troops. According to the American Legion, being deployed in a combat zone, even on a peacekeeping or training mission, requires a constant state of awareness that can lead to feelings of intense fear, helplessness, hopelessness, and horror.
On the morning of August 3rd, the 57th Georgia rode into Knoxville. The very next morning, they received surprising news. They'd be heading out again to Clinton, 18 miles away. But this time, they wouldn't be taking the train. They'd be marching.
The soldiers begrudgingly packed up their tents, cookware, and personal chests and turned them over to the quartermaster. They'd only be able to take what they could carry, and even that was almost too much. With guns slung over their shoulders, knapsacks on their backs, and heavy cartridge boxes tied around their waists, every step was an effort.
Their first day of marching was a hot one. The sun beat down, and clouds of dust rose up from the dry ground, choking them as they passed. And when night fell, they were left to lie on the floor of the woods without tents, even when it rained.
Clinton was only 18 miles away, but their journey didn't actually stop there. The troops marched incessantly for weeks, often going without food or water for days.
The only bright spot for Wright Vinson was that, on their long and circuitous journey, he was able to meet up with a friend who was holding on to Christiana's daguerreotype. It was a little too dark, but it looked exactly like her, and baby Charlie was getting so big, Wright almost didn't recognize him. He tucked it away and carried it with him, holding it close every night as he slept on the cold, bare ground.
With each passing day, the number of men dwindled. Rather than continue on with the grueling, depressingly pointless work, dozens of soldiers decided to desert, running off into the woods, never to be seen again. Hundreds more were falling ill, or faking illness in an attempt to shirk their duties.
The brigade surgeon, Dr. George Petty, had the unenviable task of deciding which men were sick enough to be sent to the hospital and which were fit enough to march. In mid-August, he examined Wright Vinson, who was coming down with chronic headaches and stomach aches. He was obviously exhausted, dehydrated, and malnourished, but so was everyone else. Wright was declared fit for duty, and begrudgingly, he joined his comrades on their next assignment, transporting supply wagons across the Cumberland Mountains and into Kentucky.
It was a 150-mile journey through steep mountain terrain, so steep that they had to hitch a dozen horses to each artillery piece to haul them up the slope. And even then, the animals were struggling. The soldiers had to attach another set of ropes and help the horses pull the artillery along.
It took 5 days to make it over the mountains. Then it took another 3 days to descend into Kentucky and meet up with the rest of their division in Barberville. They stumbled into camp on August 21st, starving, dehydrated, and absolutely exhausted. But after just a few days of rest, they were instructed to head back where they came from.
Rural Kentucky was sharply divided between Union and Confederate supporters. The isolated mountain village the troops had landed in was staunchly pro-Union and thus unfriendly. Short on supplies, the division would be setting out for Lexington, where the locals might give them more support. But a brigade had to stay behind and guard the passage at Cumberland Gap. And that brigade included the 57th Georgia Regiment.
So they turned around and retraced their steps through the mountains. The days were all starting to blend together. But if they strained to remember the date, it had been about 3 weeks of constant marching since they left Knoxville.
For most of the journey, their only food was what they could scavenge: crab apples, corn, whatever water they could suck out of tree branches and roots. 15-year-old Robert Braswell was still growing. He was over 6 foot now, nearly a head taller than the rest of his companions. But at the same time, he was getting so thin that it looked like he'd been stretched out by a taffy puller.
But while the brigade was making their way back through the mountains, they came across their salvation, a Yankee supply caravan. 300 wagons tracing the same path the Georgians had followed just days earlier.
The 300 wagons were no match for the 2,500 Confederate troops. They easily commandeered the supply convoy and raided their stocks. Sugar, coffee, flour, bacon, and more.
The Yankees apparently were dining in luxury, but now the spoils of war belonged to the rebels.
This was a victory on two fronts. They won food for themselves, and they starved out the enemy troops who were waiting for the supplies to arrive. Revitalized, they marched on to Cumberland Gap and blocked the passage, preventing any more Union troops from coming in or out of the mountains.
Finally, the 57th got a moment to rest. For a few days, all they had to do was stand there and stare down the 16 Union regiments who were now trapped in the mountain ridge, with no supplies and no way to escape. The stage was perfectly set for a battle.
Over near Lexington, the rest of the Confederate division was readying their rifles for a decisive victory. And at Cumberland Gap, the 57th Georgia Regiment was about to practice a tried and true combat survival strategy: not being present for the battle.
Coming up, the 57th Georgia narrowly misses the first major fight of the Kentucky campaign. Now, back to the story.
On August 29th, 1862, 6,500 Confederate troops met a Union force of about equal size on the road to Richmond, Kentucky. In the skirmish, over 5,300 Yankee soldiers were killed, wounded, or captured, and the Confederates only suffered about 450 losses in the process.
When the news reached Cumberland Gap, the 57th Georgia was, well, disappointed to have missed the action. They were also disappointed to hear their next command. Now that the rebels had won Kentucky, they were to rejoin the rest of the troops in Lexington and keep marching north. They'd be crossing the mountains again for the third time in 2 weeks.
Another infantry moved in to replace the Georgia Brigade, and off they went. At least, without supply wagons to transport, the journey was a little faster. It only took them 3 days to make it to Richmond, Kentucky on September 2nd. By the time they got there, all the other troops had moved on to Lexington, and only the aftermath of the battle remained.
It was the first real bloodshed the 57th Georgia had encountered. Fences and rail posts were torn down, the woods split by bullets. The ditches were lined with shallow, freshly dug graves. Flies swarmed around a blue pile rising from the side of the road, the uniform of a dead Yankee soldier buried in a hole barely a foot deep.
The Georgians' disappointment at missing the action was replaced by relief that they weren't among the dead. The reality of the carnage destroyed whatever romantic visions were left in young Robert Braswell's head.
The houses had been turned into hospitals for the more than 1,200 men who'd been wounded. Wright Vinson stepped in the door of one of the houses and saw dozens of bloodied men with their arms or legs blown off. Union or Confederate, it didn't matter. There were no heroes here, no winners or losers, only mangled victims.
That afternoon, Wright penned a letter to his wife to send when they finally reached Lexington. He confided, "Dear, if I could just see you, I could tell you a heap. I have walked over the battlefield. It was fought between Richmond and Lexington. Our men whipped them bad. I went in the hospital where they was. It was the worst sight I ever saw in my life."
To their relief, rations of whiskey were issued that afternoon. In a slightly lighter mood, the troops spent a calm night marching onward under the light of a brilliant moon. At each village they passed, men and women flocked toward the road, shouting, "Hurrah for the Georgia boys!"
They called back, "Hurrah for the ladies of Kentucky!"
Early the next morning, Colonel Barkalew led the 57th Georgia Regiment's march into Lexington.
Confederate flags rippled from the tops of every house. Crowds of women and children packed into the streets, waving banners and handkerchiefs, cheering over the brass band's victory song.
It was a hero's welcome for men who had done nothing but march in circles for the past month.
The intense response filled the troops with hope that the formerly neutral Kentucky would rally behind them. Now that they'd taken Lexington, they could continue north to Louisville, then Cincinnati. Soon, the entire continent would belong to the Confederacy.
But when the patriotic fervor died down, that support from Kentucky never materialized. The 57th Georgia Regiment's borrowed victory at Richmond would be their last.
Throughout September, the two divisions of Confederate forces in Kentucky, led by Generals Edmund Kirby Smith and Braxton Bragg, marched their troops in different directions over hundreds of miles of ground with no communication or clear strategy. In late September, General Bragg was overheard murmuring, "This campaign must be won by marching, not fighting."
And that was all the 57th Georgia knew of warfare. By the time they settled into camp at Knoxville in late October, the regiment had marched more than 1,000 miles in 11 weeks without firing a single shot at Yankee troops. The men on the ground had no idea what was going on, either in their own camp or in the war at large. When Colonel Barkalew called roll, the weary troops realized they'd lost 87 men to disease, nearly a tenth of the entire regiment.
Throughout the Kentucky campaign in the autumn of 1862, at least 15,000 Confederate soldiers were hospitalized, 3,000 were captured as prisoners, and untold hundreds had died, mostly from disease, not combat. The eager young men who'd enlisted with dreams of defending their country on the battlefield were starting to wonder what it was all for. Nothing had come of their victory in Richmond. All that bloodshed, and what was the point?
On November 6th, Wright Vinson finally got a chance to send another letter home to his wife, Christiana, for the first time in 2 months. He wrote, "Hoping these few lines may come to hand and find you all enjoying all the sweets of life. But it is far to the contrary with me. When I left you, I left all my joy behind. I have nothing to write you that will interest you in any way. I can't tell you how long we will stay here. It is unknown to us where we will go when we leave here. If peace was made now, I would be one of the happiest boys you ever saw in your life.
Although post-traumatic stress disorder wasn't officially recognized until the 1980s, scores of Civil War veterans were diagnosed with nostalgia, the popular term for anxiety, depression, and homesickness observed among soldiers. Wright seemed to be displaying several hallmark symptoms of PTSD, including alienation, emotional numbness, and a lack of hope for the future.
As the holidays approached, Wright submitted a request for a brief furlough. It was promptly denied. He was going to be stuck at camp until the war was over. Every night, he fell asleep holding on to his daguerreotype of Christiana and Charlie. He dreamed of reaching out and embracing his wife, and one night, he awoke to realize he was snuggling up to one of his bunkmates instead.
Wright didn't find it very humorous. Dreams were his only respite from the hopeless conditions around camp. There was plenty of meat and flour, but no salt, which meant all the meat went rancid long before they could eat it. The only option was to buy fresh produce from nearby farms, but Wright had lost his wallet at some point during their endless march through Kentucky, and his brother William had already sent his salary home, so neither of them had any money for decent food or even soap. William was toughing it out, but the diet of stale bread and coffee was making Wright terribly sick, and after a month without washing his clothes, he was covered in lice.
On November 11th, Wright penned another letter to Christiana. "Darling, I never wanted to go home as bad in my life as I do now, and if they don't give me a furlough, I'm going anyhow. I will have to desert. The men is deserting more or less every night. I want to know what you think of it. My life ain't no satisfaction to me, and I'd just as soon die as to live."
There were a few problems with desertion. For one, it was a crime that carried a possible death sentence, which meant any soldier who ditched their duty would have to hide out as a fugitive for the rest of the war. Beyond that, army companies were organized by county, so runaways would inevitably have to face their old brothers in arms back home and own up to the fact that they'd abandoned them. It was that camaraderie that bound the soldiers together more than any abstract loyalty to the Southern cause.
On December 18th, the 57th Georgia was ordered to leave Tennessee and travel by rail to Jackson, Mississippi. What adventures lay there, no one was sure. But at least they didn't have to march this time.
Heading southwest meant passing through Georgia. Just a few days before Christmas, the train stopped in Atlanta. Wright realized he could sneak off, catch a train to Fort Valley, spend the holidays at home, and then catch up and meet the troops in Jackson before anyone realized he was gone.
William urged his little brother to do it. He'd stay and cover for him. After all, Wright had a wife and child to look after, and William didn't. If one of them got to spend Christmas at home, it should be Wright. Maybe some real food and decent rest would help him recover some strength. But as the train loaded back up, Wright chickened out. Deserting was too risky. If he was caught, it could bring more trouble for his family than it was worth. He sat down and watched out the window as Atlanta disappeared into the hillside.
After a quiet Christmas and New Year's in transit, the 57th Georgia made it to Jackson on January 6th. They set up camp and took roll. The Vinson Brothers Company F, which had comprised over 100 soldiers in May, was now down to less than 50. They hadn't seen a day of combat. Their ranks had been thinned by disease and malnutrition.
As soon as they settled in, Wright Vinson was once again in Dr. Petty's chair. He had persistent pain in his head and back. The doctor diagnosed it as rheumatism and told him he'd feel better with some rest.
But it wasn't rheumatism. It was smallpox. A week later, Wright was taken to the hospital in Jackson. William and the rest of the men in their squad were quarantined in a separate camp in case they were infected too. Smallpox is extremely contagious and fatal in 3 out of 10 cases. An outbreak could decimate the army's ranks.
William begged the officers to let him go to the hospital with Wright. He didn't care if he caught the virus. He couldn't leave his little brother to suffer alone.
But they held him back. The 57th Georgia couldn't afford another dead soldier.
Lying on his cot in the smallpox ward, Wright clung to life for about a week as blisters covered his skin and internal bleeding sapped his strength. All he'd wanted since he first enlisted was to go home, and now it looked like he never would.
He couldn't even write a letter to tell his family goodbye, out of fear the virus would be transferred onto the paper. For the protection of his loved ones, he'd have to leave them in silence.
Wright Vincent spent his last days alone. He died on January 18th, at the age of 23, the victim of a war in which he never fired a single shot. He was unceremoniously buried in an unmarked grave somewhere in Jackson, Mississippi.
William was still in quarantine when he heard the news. It was a senseless death for a cause none of them understood. When he was finally cleared by the doctor, he returned to duty with a hardness in his heart. It wasn't the Yankees who killed his brother. It was the Civil War itself. But he had no choice but to strap on his boots and keep fighting.
Just a few days after Wright's death in late January, the regiment left Jackson for Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union General Grant was marching 7 divisions of troops towards Vicksburg, converging on Champion Hill from 3 different directions. William Vinson and the 57th Georgia Regiment were finally about to see combat.
Thanks for listening to Survival. Next week, we'll follow the surviving members of the 57th Georgia Regiment as they fight their first battle in a full year of service. For more information, amongst the many sources we used, we found Hells Broke Loose in Georgia, Survival in a Civil War Regiment by Scott Walker, extremely helpful to our research.
You can find all of Parcast's shows on Spotify and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Survival was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Libeskind. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Survival is written by Kate Gallagher and stars Irma Blanco and Tim Johnson.